This is lesson one, which is a short review of the first six chapters of Daniel and then an overview of chapter seven. The book of Daniel begins by stating that during the third year of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar besieged Jerusalem. God gave Judah into the hand of the Babylonians. Why did God allow the Babylonians to destroy his temple and to take Judah captive? The very short answer is that God not only allowed it to happen, he sent the Babylonians to punish Judah for disobeying his law and for turning away from him to idol worship. Through Moses, God had instructed his people how they were to live. But the people did not obey God's law, which included the command to give the land a Sabbath rest every seventh year. Thus the Lord judged Judah. He sent the Babylonians, who tore them from the land of Judah and destroyed the temple and the cities. The people of Judah went into exile in Babylon for 70 years. They endured 70 years of captivity because of their idolatry and their disobedience to God. We will begin the review of each of the chapters by placing them on the timeline that is provided in your materials. Verse 1 of chapter 1 tells us that the events of that chapter occurred in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim. Looking at the chart on the timeline, here is Daniel's life with his estimated time of birth. Here is the reign of Jehoiakim. And since Daniel was taken captive in Jehoiakim's third year, Daniel would have been about 15 when he was taken. Remember, however, that some scholars think he may have been as young as 12. It is so easy for me to simply state the fact that Daniel was taken captive to Babylon. But if you stop and think about it, you can only begin to imagine how traumatic this was. This was a boy who had lived a life of privilege because he was a member either of the royal family or at least a member of the aristocracy. He was ripped away from his family and all that was familiar to him, and he was taken with other frightened preteen and teenage boys and forced to march between 800 and 900 miles to live among people who spoke a language these boys did not understand and whose ways and culture were foreign to them. Daniel never saw his family again, so far as we know, and we do know that he never went back home for the rest of his life. Back to the text. Verse 1 of chapter 1 also tells us that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. Secular history tells us that Nebuchadnezzar's father, Nabopolassar, was actually the king when this first siege against Jerusalem began, but he died while Nebuchadnezzar was conducting the siege, so Nebuchadnezzar hurried back to Babylon to claim his throne. Thus, this year of the first siege, 605 BC, was the year that Nebuchadnezzar ascended the throne of Babylon. By Jewish reckoning, this would therefore be considered Nebuchadnezzar's first year. The Babylonians, however, did not consider the year of accession in their method of accounting, so they would have considered Nebuchadnezzar's second year, that is, his first entire full year on the throne, they would have considered that to be his first year. Continuing now with chapter 1, we learn that Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were among the sons of the royal family and the nobles of Judah who were taken from their families to be educated in the Babylonian customs, literature, language, and religion. In an attempt to subdue any rebellious tendencies in these teenage boys and to assimilate them into the new culture, the boys were renamed. These boys were renamed Belteshazzar, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Their Hebrew names, which were related to God, were changed to names that reflected the Babylonian gods. But verse 8 of chapter 1 tells us that Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. Although Daniel was only between the age of 12 and 15 at this time, he exhibited astonishing maturity. In addition, the text of chapter 1 makes it clear that God was working in the hearts of those who were in charge of the young captives, and Daniel and his friends were granted the request. God blessed the faithfulness of these young boys and granted them knowledge and intelligence, and even gave Daniel the ability to interpret visions and dreams. At the end of the 3-year period of training, the commander of the officials presented all the young captives before Nebuchadnezzar, who examined them and found that Daniel and his companions were 10 times better. The expression literally is 10 hands better than all the magicians and conjurers who were in his realm. In chapter 2, Daniel's God-given ability to interpret visions and dreams was put to the test. Here on the timeline, I have placed the timing of chapter 1. Chapter 2 begins by giving us a time frame. It is the 2nd year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. Since, however, the Babylonian method of reckoning did not count the year that a king ascended the throne as one of the years of his reign, what the Hebrews and what we would consider to be the 2nd year of his reign, the Babylonians would consider to be the first. That means that even though verse 1 of chapter 2 says that the events of this chapter occurred in the 2nd year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, it is possible that it was the 3rd year of his reign by our system of reckoning. Thus, Daniel and his companions would have completed their 3-year period of training, or at least they would be very near the end of it. Although I am not able to place the arrow exactly on the chart, the year would be 603 BC. 605 would have been the 1st year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, 604 would be the 2nd year, and 603 would be the 3rd year, if we're using the Jewish and our method of reckoning. At this time, which we're considering was probably the 3rd year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams which troubled him. He called in all his wise men and asked them to tell him both the content of the dream and the interpretation. The text makes it clear that Daniel and his companions were not present among the wise men who were called before Nebuchadnezzar. Well, naturally, the wise men protested that they could not possibly know the content of the dream, but they would be happy to provide an interpretation for the king if the king would tell them what he had dreamed. The thing which the king demands is difficult, the men protested, and there is no one else who could declare it to the king except gods, whose dwelling place is not with mortal flesh. The text does not tell us why King Nebuchadnezzar was testing his wise men by demanding that they tell him what he had dreamed, but their failure infuriated him, and he demanded that all the wise men be rounded up and executed. It is at this point that we learn that Daniel and his friends were considered to be part of this class of men, despite the fact that they were not present in this exchange with the king. When Daniel learned of the king's order, he went in and requested of the king that he would give him more time in order that he might declare the interpretation to the king. When Nebuchadnezzar granted his request, Daniel returned to his companions, and the 4 young men turned to the God of heaven for help. Although all 4 young men were praying, it was to Daniel alone that God gave the content of Nebuchadnezzar's dream and then the interpretation. Daniel responded with a beautiful doxology of praise and then returned to Nebuchadnezzar to tell him that there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. Daniel then detailed Nebuchadnezzar's dream and followed with the interpretation. Nebuchadnezzar had dreamed of an enormous statue that terrified him. The head of that statue was made of fine gold, its breast and its arms were of silver, its belly and its thighs were of bronze, its legs were of iron, and its feet and toes were made partly of iron and partly of clay. Then a stone was cut out without hands, and it struck the statue on its feet and crushed them. Then the rest of the statue was also crushed. Having set out the content of the dream, Daniel proceeded to the interpretation. He explained that Nebuchadnezzar represented the head of gold. The silver part of the statue represented another kingdom which would arise after Babylon. At this point, we can see that kings and kingdoms are interchangeable. They are synonymous. Nebuchadnezzar representing the head of gold would also represent the kingdom of Babylon. The kingdom represented by the silver would be replaced by a third kingdom of bronze, which in turn would be replaced by a fourth kingdom as strong as iron. But in the days of the kings represented by the feet and the toes of the statue, the God of heaven would set up a kingdom that would never be destroyed. Nebuchadnezzar reacted to Daniel's message by falling on his face to give homage to Daniel. He then promoted Daniel and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and the chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. At Daniel's request, he also appointed Daniel's three companions over the administration of the province of Babylon. The exact time frame of chapter 3 is not given. Since, however, it followed the appointment of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to the administration of the province of Babylon in chapter 2, we can safely assume that the events of this chapter occurred after the events of chapter 2. When Nebuchadnezzar reflected on the interpretation of his dream of chapter 2, it is possible that he did not like the fact that his kingdom, which was represented by the gold head of the statue, would come to an end and would be replaced by the kingdom represented by the silver of the statue. He would naturally want his own kingdom to last forever. Perhaps it is for this reason that chapter 3 begins by telling us that Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, the height of which was 90 feet, and the width of which was 9 feet. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. He then required that all his subjects should bow down and worship his golden image. Refusal to obey would result in a horrible death in the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. Daniel's three companions refused to obey the order. Conspicuous by his absence was Daniel himself. He is not mentioned in this chapter, and the text does not tell us where he was when the events that are recounted here were occurring. The text does tell us, however, that certain Chaldeans, who undoubtedly chafed at being put under the authority of these foreign captives, noticed the refusal of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and hauled them out before the king. Perhaps because the king was so shocked that these exalted administrators of his should disobey his commands, Nebuchadnezzar gave the men another chance to obey, but they did not need to think about their response. They expressed their loyalty to God, even if he should choose not to deliver them from death in the fiery furnace. Infuriated, Nebuchadnezzar had the furnace heated 7 times hotter, and the men were bound and thrown into the furnace. Observing from a safe distance, Nebuchadnezzar noticed that instead of seeing 3 men writhing in agony, he saw 4 men unbound, loosed, and walking about in the fire without harm, and the appearance of the 4th man was like a son of the gods. He ordered the men to come out of the fire, and when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego obeyed, Nebuchadnezzar's officials gathered around and saw that the fire had had no effect on either the bodies or the clothes of the men. Not even the smell of fire had come upon them. The only thing that had burned was the rope that had bound the men as they were thrown into the fiery furnace. Nebuchadnezzar's response to this display of the power of God to deliver his own was to issue a decree forbidding anyone to speak anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. The timing of the events of chapter 4 is questionable, although it can be said with some degree of certainty that it happened after chapter 3 but before chapter 5. This time I'm using the time chart from your materials in part 2. It's on page 149 in the appendix. This is how the precept position shows the ambiguity of the timing of chapter 4. Chapter 4 is written in the form of an announcement or a notice or perhaps even a journal entry from Nebuchadnezzar himself to the world at large. Nebuchadnezzar has had another dream that distresses him. Again, he calls in the wise men who are still around, by the way, because of Daniel's ability to interpret the dream of chapter 2. This time the king does divulge the content of the dream, but once again, the bankruptcy of worldly wisdom is about to be contrasted with the glory of heavenly wisdom. The wise men are stumped. Do not miss the pun there. Once more, the text does not tell us why Daniel was not present when the rest of the wise men were summoned before Nebuchadnezzar. What we are told is that, finally, Daniel came in to the king. Nebuchadnezzar's dream was of a tree which grew so large that its height reached to the sky and it could be seen throughout the whole earth. The tree provided shade for the beasts of the field and homes for the birds of the sky. In the dream, the tree was chopped down, but the stump with its roots in the ground remained. At that point, the pronouns changed from it to he and him. The angelic watchers in the dream decreed that he would share with the beasts in the grass of the earth, and his mind would be changed from that of a man to that of a beast. Daniel confirmed Nebuchadnezzar's suspicion that the tree represented himself, and he advised the king to turn away from his sins, that the prophecy of the dream might be averted. Apparently, however, Nebuchadnezzar did not heed Daniel's advice, even though the text tells us that he was given 12 months to do so. Instead, Nebuchadnezzar grew in pride, and he gave himself all the credit for having built up his own kingdom. Immediately after his boast, the prophecy was fulfilled, and Nebuchadnezzar became like an animal until he was able to acknowledge the sovereignty of God over even himself. At that point, his sanity returned and he was restored to his kingdom. Scholars differ over the interpretation of this chapter, whether it means that Nebuchadnezzar had a true salvation experience, but that is a question that will not be answered until we get to heaven ourselves. The theme of the book of Daniel comes out of this chapter. Verse 17 of chapter 4 states, "The Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whom he wishes and sets over it the lowliest of men." The English translation is awkward because it is not clear what the antecedent of it is, but plainly what is meant is that God bestows earthly rulership on whom he wishes. This theme of the sovereignty of God is restated later in chapter 4. Verse 35 says that he does according to his will in the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of earth, and no one can ward off his hand or say to him, "What hast thou done?" In contrast to chapter 4, chapter 5 can be precisely placed on the timeline. The events of chapter 5 record the last night of the Babylonian Empire, which is right here on the timeline. The rest of the kingdom of Babylon had already fallen to the Persians and the Medes, but the city of Babylon was so well fortified that its residents considered it, impregnable. The king of Babylon at that time was Belshazzar, and he was throwing a feast, perhaps to bolster the morale of his people, and also perhaps to remind the Babylonian gods that, and remember, this is their view, not ours, to remind these Babylonian gods that they had, after all, in the past conquered the Hebrew God by empowering Nebuchadnezzar to conquer Judah and to take the gold and silver vessels out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem. These vessels had apparently remained unused in the temples of the Babylonian gods from the time of Nebuchadnezzar. But Belshazzar brought them to the feast and used them to toast the Babylonian gods, and as I said, perhaps to remind them that they needed to act again. In the midst of this feast, Belshazzar witnessed a disembodied hand writing a message on the plaster wall of his throne room. Once more, Daniel was called in, and he interpreted the message of the handwriting, telling Belshazzar that God had numbered the days of his life and of his kingdom, and the number was up. In addition, God had weighed him on his scales and found that Belshazzar did not measure up. He was too light. As a result, his kingdom would be divided. Chapter 5 ends by telling us that that very night, Darius the Mede received the kingdom. Secular history records that the invading Persians and Medes diverted the waters of the Euphrates River that went through the city of Babylon. And when the level of the water of the river was low enough to wade through, then they entered the city through the river. Once again, the sovereignty of God is demonstrated by the language that is used. It says, Darius received, that is, he was given the kingdom. Daniel's doxology in chapter 2 fits again just as well here. God removes kings, and God establishes kings. The events of chapter 6 occurred after the events of chapter 5, because now Darius is in the process of setting up his government. I couldn't get the arrows any closer together than that, but chapter 6 probably occurs closely on the heels of chapter 5. And now we can see on this timeline that the events of the first 6 chapters occurred in chronological order, one after the other, and that they spread out over the vast majority of Daniel's long life. By this point, Daniel has been serving in the various administrations of government from the beginning of Nebuchadnezzar's reign to the end of the Babylonian Empire and now into the Medo-Persian Empire. Therefore, by the time of this chapter, Daniel was an elderly man, possibly around 80 years old. Despite the change of rulership, Daniel's integrity and value in government service had become apparent to all. So verse 2 of chapter 6 tells us that Darius appoints Daniel as one of 3 commissioners to oversee the 120 satraps, or governors, of provinces in his kingdom. But Daniel was so amazing in his performance of his duties that the king was not going to have him be merely one of the top 3 commissioners, but now in charge of the entire kingdom. This would be a position that was directly under the king, a position of enormous power and authority. That's even better than being the 3rd ruler under Belshazzar, because Belshazzar's rule ended within hours of his bestowing that honor on Daniel. Well, once again, those who would be under Daniel's authority took umbrage at the elevation of this captive of Judah to such a position of power. So the various satraps and governors, unable to find any fault or vice with which to trap Daniel, decided they would trap him in his integrity. Now, it just says something about a man that even his enemies could rely on him to remain faithful to his God. These conniving government officials approached the gullible Darius, who should have known better than to fall for such obsequious flattery, and they convinced him to issue an edict that anyone who made a petition to any god or man besides the king himself for 30 days would be cast into the lion's den. The text tells us that Daniel knew about this edict, but he did not change his practice of opening his windows toward Jerusalem and praying 3 times a day to God. Daniel's enemies lay in wait and caught Daniel making petition and supplication before his God. In the picture, you can see the men. There they are, behind the curtain, spying on Daniel. They hauled Daniel before the king and reminded him of his order. Darius, now painfully aware of how he had been used, spent the entire day trying to find a way around his own edict. But by the evening, he had reached no solution, and he was forced to give the order, and Daniel was cast into the lion's den. I like this particular picture that depicts Daniel in the lion's den because it demonstrates that Daniel feared God more than he feared the lions. He wasn't even looking at the lions. He was looking at the Lord. After a sleepless night, the king rushed to the lion's den and called out to Daniel with a troubled voice, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you constantly serve, been able to deliver you from the lions?" To his great relief, Daniel answered him and told him that God had sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they had not harmed him. The king immediately ordered that Daniel be taken out of the lion's den, and his accusers suffered the fate that they would have consigned Daniel to. Darius then issued a decree similar to that of Nebuchadnezzar, which praised Daniel's God and required all the subjects of the land to fear Daniel's God. Chapter 6 ends with the statement that this Daniel enjoyed success in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Now let's summarize these first 6 chapters. In chapter 1, Daniel and his 3 friends were taken captive along with the best of the youths of Judah. And after a 3-year period of training in the Babylonian culture, language, and religion, they were put in the service of King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. In chapter 2, King Nebuchadnezzar had a dream that troubled him greatly. God gave Daniel both the content of the dream and its interpretation. The dream was of a statue made of different materials, and the dream represented the present kingdom of Babylon and future kingdoms that would come after it. In chapter 3, Nebuchadnezzar set up an enormous golden statue in the plain of Dura and demanded that all his subjects bow down and worship this statue, which may have been in his own image. Although Daniel was not present when the events of chapter 3 took place, his friends, who had been renamed with the Babylonian names of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, were as faithful as he was, and they refused to bow down to the image, even when threatened with death in a fiery furnace. A 4th man, who looked like a son of the gods, was observed by Nebuchadnezzar walking with the 3 condemned men in the midst of the furnace, and Nebuchadnezzar was once more forced to acknowledge the sovereignty of their God over his gods. In chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar had another dream, this time of a great tree that was chopped down. Although this time he did not withhold the content of the dream from his wise men, they were still unable to interpret it. But God again gave Daniel the wisdom to accurately interpret the prophetic dream. Nebuchadnezzar did not heed the warning of the dream, and so it was fulfilled in his temporary insanity, which lasted until he recognized the sovereignty of God over all the realm of mankind. The events of chapter 5 record the last night of the Babylonian Empire and also the last night of the life of the last king of Babylon, Belshazzar. Daniel was called in to interpret handwriting that appeared on the wall during a feast held by Belshazzar. The prophecy of the handwriting was fulfilled that very night as the Medes and the Persians invaded Babylon. Because the events of chapter 6 occurred after those of chapter 5, the king in this chapter was Darius. Darius was duped into issuing an edict, which he could not retract, as a result of which Daniel spent the night with the lions in their den. But God delivered Daniel, and he lived to serve his foreign masters for the remainder of his life. Looking for segments or divisions of a book is one of the tools of observation. Last week in the introduction, I stated that Precept Ministries divides the book of Daniel into two parts. We have just completed a quick review of the first six chapters, which we covered last semester in part one. I said that this is one of the ways to divide the book of Daniel, and when we considered this way last semester, we pictured the book of Daniel as a loaf of bread divided into two halves. In the first six chapters, the kings dreamed and Daniel interpreted. In the last six chapters, it was Daniel who dreamed or had visions, and angels provided the interpretation. Dividing the book this way is consistent with the fact that the first six chapters are in chronological order, a fact which we have confirmed by charting them on a timeline. And while the last six chapters are also in chronological order relative to one another, they dovetail into the events of the first six chapters. If you are dividing the book this way, then you could characterize the first six chapters as historical and the last six chapters as apocalyptic or prophetic. Dividing the book into these two segments also makes sense from another perspective, because it is at chapter 7 that Daniel changes the pronouns from third person to first person. Did any of you pick that up in your observation? Last week, I also said that there were other possible ways to divide the book into segments depending upon the point of emphasis. For example, another possible division of the book of Daniel is based on the change of language in the original from Hebrew to Aramaic and then back to Hebrew. Thus, instead of two halves of one loaf of bread, the book could be divided into three parts of a layer cake. Like this. The first chapter and the first few verses of chapter 2, which were written in Hebrew, would constitute an introduction. This is the top layer. The middle layer is the section of Daniel which was written in Aramaic and which describes the times of the Gentiles. The bottom layer of the cake represents the section written in Hebrew and which talks about Israel in relationship to the Gentiles. Layer cake division also makes sense because chapter 7, which we're about to start, is still in the Aramaic section, which deals with the times of the Gentiles. It is with the switch back to Hebrew at chapter 8 that the focus shifts back to Israel. There is yet another way you might choose to divide the book. This way, you would divide the segments into the chapters in which the Babylonian kingdom reigned. That would be one segment, and that would be chapters 1 through 5 and chapters 7 and 8. The other segment would be the chapters in which the Medo-Persian kingdom reigned. That would be chapter 6 and 9, 10, 11, and 12. But since these are not clean divisions, such as a loaf of bread cut in two or even a layer cake, I used a marbled cake to depict this division. The point of all this is not to make you hungry, but to show you that these divisions are different ways to observe the text of Daniel and to see that these divisions are based upon the emphasis or the perspective you choose, whether it is historical versus prophetic, or Hebrew or Jewish versus Aramaic and Gentiles, or Babylonian events versus Medo-Persian events. So now let us turn to an overview of chapter 7, remembering that the pronouns change from third person to first person at this point, and that we are moving out of the purely historical chapters into the chapters that focus more on prophecy. But we are still in the middle layer of the cake, that section of the book which was written in Aramaic and which focuses on the Gentiles rather than on Israel. In the introduction to the book of Daniel last week, I showed you this slide, and I said that through his prophets, God communicated his will for mankind and portions of his eternal plan for the ages. Amos 3:7 says, "Surely the Lord God does nothing unless he reveals his secret counsel to his servants, the prophets." In Isaiah 46, the Lord God said through Isaiah, "I am God and there is no other. I am God, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times things which have not been done, saying, my purpose will be established and I will accomplish all my good pleasure." In these last six chapters of the book of Daniel, God does just that. He declares the end from the beginning and from ancient times things which have not been done. Between 500 and 600 years before Christ, God granted Daniel the most extraordinary, sweeping, panoramic view of events that were to come from Daniel's time up until the time of the second coming of Christ. The beauty of the study this semester is that there will be no doubt that God is sovereign over all the history of nations and of mankind. Now let's look at the text of Daniel chapter 7. Verse 1 sets the time frame. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions in his mind as he lay on his bed. Then he wrote the dream down and related the following summary of it. Let's see where this chapter fits on the timeline. Here's chapter 5, which we can place precisely because it records the last night of the Babylonian kingdom. Chapter 6 follows closely on the heels of chapter 5 because the conquering king, Darius, is setting up the administration of his government. Chapter 7, the one we're looking at now, occurs out of chronological order. It doesn't happen after chapter 6. It takes us back to when the Babylonian kingdom still existed and Belshazzar was still on the throne. It was about 14 years before the end of the Babylonian Empire, 14 years before the events of chapter 5. Thus, we can see that Daniel was about 70 years old at the time the events of chapter 7 took place. Since we will be comparing chapter 7 with chapter 2, when Nebuchadnezzar had his dream about the statue, let's see when that occurred on the timeline. The events of chapter 2 happened about 50 years prior to the events of chapter 7. So Daniel was approximately 20 years old when he interpreted Nebuchadnezzar's dream of the statue, and he was about 70 years old when he himself had this dream of the four beasts. Now remember, these ages are approximations because nobody knows the year of his birth. Back to Daniel 7, verse 2. It is at this point that the narrative switches to first person. Verse 2. Daniel said, "I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four beasts were coming up from the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had the wings of an eagle. I kept looking until its wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. A human mind was also given to it." And behold, another beast, a second one resembling a bear. And it was raised up on one side, and three ribs were in its mouth between its teeth. And thus they said to it, Arise, devour much meat. After this I kept looking, and behold, another one, like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. This beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. Verse 7. After this I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying and extremely strong. It had large iron teeth. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet. And it was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. In the homework, Kay then asks us to compare this vision that Daniel had at about age 70 with the dream of the statue that Nebuchadnezzar had had approximately 50 years prior. That dream, of course, is recorded in chapter 2. The head of gold of the statue represented Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian Empire. The first beast that Daniel described was that of a lion whose wings were plucked, and then the lion was made to stand and was given a human mind. There are some correlations here to chapter 4, in which Nebuchadnezzar had his pride plucked during his period of insanity, and then he was restored to sanity and to his former glory. The breast and arms of the statue were silver, and we already know from the study of Daniel that the empire which succeeded the Babylonian Empire, because it conquered it, was the Medo-Persian Empire. The second beast that Daniel described in chapter 7 was that of a bear that was raised up on one side. A bear is larger than a lion, and the Medo-Persian Empire was larger geographically than Babylon. Most scholars agree that the three ribs represent the nations which the Medo-Persian Empire conquered: Babylon, Lydia, also known as Turkey, and Egypt. The two arms of the bear indicate a combination of the Medes and the Persians, but the fact that the bear was raised up on one side would point to the rise of the Persians to greater power than the Medes. Incidentally, lions and bears were once indigenous to the land of Canaan, the promised land. In 1 Samuel chapter 17, verses 33 to 37, the context of that is that David, not Daniel, David, is seeking permission from King Saul to go up against Goliath. Saul protests that David is not able to fight Goliath, but David tells Saul that when he was tending his father's sheep, he had had occasion to kill both the lion and the bear to protect his flock. Now we move to the third kingdom. The bronze belly and upper thighs of the statue represented a kingdom that would rule over the whole earth. The third beast that Daniel described in chapter 7 was a leopard who had dominion given to it. The legs of the statue of chapter 2 were of iron, and its feet and toes were partly of iron and partly of clay. This kingdom, though it was a divided kingdom, crushed and shattered and broke all the others into pieces. Verse 44 of chapter 2 refers to the days of those kings. Scholars believe that the antecedent to that reference of those kings is in the prior two verses, verses 42 and 43, which describe the kingdom represented by the 10 toes of the feet. The fourth beast that Daniel described in chapter 7, I will be calling the DT beast, because Daniel described it as dreadful and terrifying. So dreadful and terrifying, the DT beast. While all four of the beasts are described in chapter 7, verse 3, as different from one another, verse 7 describes this fourth beast as different from all the beasts that were before it, and this one had 10 horns. Like the kingdom represented by the legs of iron, it devoured and crushed and trampled the others. Like the iron legs of the statue, the fourth beast is a fourth kingdom, and the ten horns, like the ten toes, are ten kings. The lion, the bear, the leopard, and the DT beast probably are characterized as beasts because they represent kingdoms that were opposed to God and therefore were also opposed to his people. The beast kingdoms rejected the knowledge of God and persecuted his people. Unlike chapter 2, however, there are additional details given us in chapter 7 prior to the destruction of the beast kingdoms. Chapter 7, we're up to verse 8. Verse 8. While I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them, that's among the ten horns, and three of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth uttering great boasts. There is a wealth of information packed into that one verse, information that has no parallel in chapter 2. And yet more details are given. Look at verse 9. I kept looking until thrones were set up, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His vesture was like white snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames, its wheels were a burning fire. A river of fire was flowing and coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands were attending him, and myriads upon myriads were standing before him. The court sat, and the books were opened. Then I kept looking because of the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain, and its body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but an extension of life was granted to them for an appointed period of time. Now, the parallel with the stone that was cut out of the mountains without hands in chapter 2 picks up again with the next verse of chapter 7, verse 13. I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming, and he came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. This description of Jesus' arrival in Daniel 7:13 parallels the description in Matthew chapter 24, verse 30. I'm going to read verses 29 and 30 to get the context. But immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of the heaven will be shaken. And then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and here's the parallel, they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. One other interesting note about Daniel chapter 7, verse 13, is that Jesus is described as one like a son of man. This is the only place in the entire Old Testament where Jesus is referred to with that title. In contrast, in the New Testament, there are 84 passages in which Jesus refers to himself with that title. Back to Daniel chapter 7, verse 14. And to him, Jesus, was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom, that all the peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. Well, doesn't that sound like the description of the kingdom at the end of Daniel chapter 2? Here's Daniel chapter 2, verse 44. And in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed, same words, and that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms, but it will itself endure forever. Clearly, the prophecy of verse 14 of Daniel chapter 7 has not yet been fulfilled, because all peoples and nations and men of every language are not serving him now. But if the ten horns of Daniel chapter 7 are the parallel of the 10 toes of Daniel chapter 2, then Daniel chapter 2 verses 34, 35, 44, and 45 explain that the Son of Man will be given dominion when the stone crushes the 10 toes in the days of those kings. What this is telling us is that the days of those 10 kings will be the days that precede the coming of the Son of Man. Therefore, the 10 toes, the 10 horns, the 10 kings point to a time yet future, because we also know that this little horned kingdom comes to an end when the Ancient of Days comes. Back to Daniel chapter 7, Daniel tells us his reaction to these visions. Verse 15, "As for me, Daniel, my spirit was distressed within me, and the visions in my mind kept alarming me. I approached one of those who were standing by and began asking him the exact meaning of all this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things." So verse 16 says that others were standing by Daniel during the time of this dream or vision. Evidently, these were angelic beings because one of them interpreted the dream or the vision for him. Beginning with verse 17 of chapter 7, the interpretation of the four beasts begins. Remember that the words kings and kingdoms are used interchangeably, so they can say king or kingdom, and it refers to both. Back in verse 3 of chapter 7, Daniel has said that the beasts came out of the sea. But now that we get to verse 17, we are told that this means from the earth. Verse 17, "These great beasts, which are four in number, are four kings who will arise from the earth. Thus, these beasts arose from the mass of humanity, and they were not of divine origin, although God is sovereign over all the nations." Remember, Daniel 2:21 says that God removes kings and establishes kings. But a cross-reference in Isaiah will help us to see that this coming out of the sea means coming out of the earth, which means coming out of the mass of humanity. Isaiah 57, verse 20. "But the wicked are like the tossing sea, for it cannot be quiet, and its waters toss up refuse and mud." Back to Daniel chapter 7, verse 18. "But the saints of the Highest One will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever for all ages to come." This verse tells us that not only does the stone of chapter 2 get the kingdom, but also the saints will receive it and possess it forever. Now Daniel asks for further clarification regarding only the fourth beast kingdom. Verse 19. "Then I desired to know the exact meaning of the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron and its claws of bronze, and which devoured, crushed, and trampled down the remaining with its feet, and the meaning of the 10 horns that were on its head, and the other horn which came up, and before which three of them fell, namely, that horn which had eyes and a mouth uttering great boasts, and which was larger in appearance than its associates." Verse 21. "I kept looking, and that horn was waging war with the saints and overpowering them until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the Highest One, and the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom." The latter part of this verse repeats verse 18, which says that the saints will receive the kingdom and possess it. At verse 23, the angelic interpreter begins to explain what Daniel has seen. I'm going to use the precept tool of making a list as we go through the interpretation so that we will have a summary that we can refer to later. Verse 23, "Thus he," meaning the angelic interpreter, "said, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which will be different from all the other kingdoms, and it will devour the whole earth and tread it down and crush it. As for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom 10 kings will arise, and another will arise after them, and he will be different from the previous ones and will subdue 3 kings. And he will speak out against the Most High. Now we're still listing out of verse 25. He will wear down the saints of the Highest One. He will intend to make alterations in times and in law. They, meaning the saints, will be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. But the court will sit forever, and his dominion will be taken away, annihilated, and destroyed forever. Now, before we go any further, I'd like to go back to the earlier verses where Daniel described the fourth beast as he was asking for its meaning. Although this list that we have just compiled from the angel's explanation includes everything that Daniel included in his description, there were a couple of times when Daniel used different expressions, and I want to include them in this list just to make it as complete as possible. The 11th horn, called the little horn in verse 8, uttered great boasts. This fact that he uttered great boasts is stated 3 times, in verse 8, in verse 11, and verse 20. Also, verse 20 describes this horn as being larger in appearance than its associates. I thought this was rather odd, since verse 8 described the horn as little. Verse 8 says, "While I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them." Since the context of the very first description of this horn is the description of the other 10 horns, after which another horn, a little horn, came up among them, I got the impression that this latter horn was smaller than the first 10. Nevertheless, verse 20 tells us that it is larger in appearance than its associates. Verse 21 tells us that the little horn that is larger than its associates waged war with the saints and overpowered them. Since we are making lists, I thought it might be helpful to make a list of all the times in chapter 7 that we are assured that despite the fact that this little horn wages war with the saints and overpowers them, ultimately the saints will be given and will possess the kingdom of the stone, stone with a capital S, of chapter 2. Daniel 7 verse 18. But the saints of the Highest One will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever for all ages to come. 7:22. Judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the Highest One, and the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. And then verse 27 of chapter 7. Then the sovereignty, the dominion, and the greatness of all the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the Highest One. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all the dominions will serve and obey him. Daniel chapter 7 up to this point describes 4 beasts, 10 horns, and a little horn, judgment being given, one like a son of man coming to the Ancient of Days and being given a dominion. Comparing the beasts of Daniel 7 to the parts of the statue in Daniel 2 reveals more details about these prophecies, especially about the fourth kingdom. But we are not finished. We will spend 2 more weeks on chapter 7, cross-referencing and incorporating several chapters from Revelation to fill in the gaps in our understanding. Moreover, the details regarding these kingdoms will be further expanded in Daniel chapter 8 and then Daniel chapters 11 and 12. Daniel's conclusion of chapter 7 is in verse 28. At this point, the revelation ended. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts were greatly alarming me, and my face grew pale, but I kept the matter to myself. At this point, you too may be feeling a little overwhelmed. If you are, then back up from verse 28 to 27 and meditate on the very intriguing language used there. It says, "The greatness of all the kingdoms will be given to the people of the saints of the Highest One." And also, you can remember that Daniel is a very important book. It takes time and concentration and discipline to study and digest all the truths it contains. Sometimes it will mean saying no to other things, even things that can be diverting and don't tax your mind. But there's no spiritual growth without effort, at times even fairly intense effort. But God instructs us in 1 Chronicles 16:11 to seek Him always, to seek His strength, to seek His face continually. And then He promises in Jeremiah 29:13, "And you will seek Me and find Me when you search for Me with all your heart." Final hymn. Thine be the glory, risen conquering Son. Endless is the victory Thou o'er death hast won. Angels in bright raiment rolled the stone away, kept the folded grave clothes where Thy body lay. Lo, Jesus meets us, risen from the tomb. Lovingly He greets us, scatters fear and gloom. Let the church with gladness hymns of triumph sing, for her Lord now liveth, death hath lost its sting. No more we doubt Thee, glorious Prince of Life. Life is not without Thee. Aid us in our strife. Make us more than conquerors through Thy deathless love. Bring us safe through Jordan to Thy home above. Thine is the glory, risen conquering Son. Endless is the victory Thou o'er death hast won. Amen.